Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, or way up to chapter 25. It's got the title of Negative Capabilities, but of course what they mean in this case is the fact that it's photographed and forms the negative image of itself. So it's a sort of rather sort of strange title for a chapter. As I do the two quotes with the author first, and the quote by Ellie Wallach in John Huston's Misfits, 1961. Got a really sing over this street sweeper, which is outside our house, which is, we had that star, it's so far away, by the time the light from it reaches here, it might not be up there anymore, which is actually true, that, not necessarily, but that'll definitely move and change. I think we've got, practically impractical stuff, 20,000, probably 100,000 light years is the greatest, not 100,000 light years, but so our entire galaxy is 100,000 light years across, so all the stars that we can see in our galaxy are 100,000 years old, and a short star lives a million years, so that's not necessarily true. Okay, by Le Corbusier, 1923. Architecture is a skillful and exact and magnificent play of volumes assembled in light. Our eyes are designed to see forms in light, which is really an intensely important thing. Long before the first photograph, the great Persian scientist Ibn al-Haytham, 965-410, invented the camera obscura, a darkened chamber into which light enters through a tiny aperture. If a reflecting surface is so placed that interrupts the entering rays, the viewer will still see a full-colour moving image upside down, the scene outside. Kepler improved the basic version by adding a lens to enhance the image quality, as described by the English diplomat Francis Bacon in 1620. So that's interesting that that seems the basic thing. That's a camera, isn't it? Camera in his room. Here's a quote from Francis Bacon. I love the chap. He hath a little black tent set up exactly close and dark, save at one hole, about an inch and a half in diameter, to which he applies a long perspective trunk with a convex lens fitted in the said hole, through which the visible radiations of all objects without are introduced, falling on the paper. Isn't that interesting? So that's, a way of looking at a lens. The next hurdle in the way of moving pictures would have to be in capture as on a screen precise images of distant figures in full colour and motion, but that was too great a leap for many centuries away. The invention of the magic lantern was another stepping stone, although he didn't invent it, a Jesuit alchemist. I love that, Jesuit alchemist. Father Anastasius Kircher, 1601-80, did publish a study of some of the principles involved in its construction. In 1646, his book on optics, Ars Magnus Lucis Umbrae, The Great Art of Light and Shadow, appeared. Among the novelties he describes are a projecting device, which a lens that focused sunlight, cast it by a mirror, and used the light from a candle or a lamp to project images. The very technique that was later refined into the magic lanterns, forerunners of film projectors. By centuries end, portable instruments of this kind were on sale in major cities in Europe. Given that chemical as well as optical principles in photography were known for the early 18th century, which is the 1700s, it was one of the enigmas of cultural histories that the photograph took so long to be invented. Not until 1826 did Joseph Nepponippis, 1765 to 1833, produce the first experiment photograph. View from the window of La Grasse, with a process he called holography, sunwriting. The exposure time was at least 8 hours. So the sunlight illuminates the photo from both left and right sides. Now this is interesting. Now perhaps it is the intellectual space held by people that would not admit another view on a page. That's just my view, that the rhetoric was still so strong that it would not allow a picture to be placed on the page. The words added pictures. That's my view. For a few years thereafter, only objects that remained immobile for several hours could be photographed. Then, in 1826, which is only 3 years, the piece teamed up with Louis Daguerre, so that daguerreotype is an old photograph, 1789 to 1851, so he's not going to live that long. And although Nepias died 4 years into the collaboration, Daguerreur went on to introduce a process involving a thin iodine layer lined applied to silver substrate in order to create a light-sensitive surface that required a much shorter exposure time. By 1839, those daguerreotypes took only about 10 minutes, and by 1842, improvements in this sensitizing step, more effective lenses had reduced it to 15 seconds. Daguerre's also created what was called a diorama, a room surrounded by newly devised equipment that produced complex light illusions. One such of these mechanisms was the phantasma, literally marketplace of ghosts. One of whose first achievements was to reproduce the effects of a sunrise, whatever that means. Englishman William Fox Talbot, 1800 to 1877, was Daguerre's main rival. He created botanical specimens around 1835 as a result of solely interaction of light and chemicals. Talbot placed a leaf on a sheet of photosensitized paper and left it out in the sun. The image of the leaf appeared as a faint, almost effervescent impression against the sun-darkened background. Produced without invention of a camera, these photograms, as he called them, seemed more the work of the sun than the photographer. Okay. Working along the same lines, Daguerre, Talbot had earlier discovered another means of fixing silver process image, but kept it secret. Okay, so this is your fixing. So this is what you expose and you put that fixing solution, and then developing. I think it's you put the developer and then the fixer. Yeah, that's what you put on. After reading about his competitor's invention, he refined his technique to make it fast enough to register people and develop what he called the calliotype process, the Greek from the callous, beautiful, which creates negative images. The earliest surviving negative paper dated 1835, so he was really quick. It is of an oriel window in the south gallery of Talbot's country house, Lancock Abbey in Wiltshire. Talbot describes how it was created. So he lives in an abbey, so he's a pretty wealthy chap. Here's a quote. "Not having with me a camera obscura of any considerable size, I constructed one out of a larger box, the image being thrown upon one end of a good object glass fixed at the opposite end. The apparatus, being armed with sensitive paper, was taken out into the summer afternoon, placed about 100 yards from a building favourably illuminated by the sun. An hour or so afterwards, I opened the box and I found depicted on the paper a very distinct representation of the building, with the exception of those parts which had been laid in shade. The place of invention now accelerated. The great astronomer John Herschel," I love John Herschel, I want to work with him. Who are the people I want to really work with? I suppose John Herschel. Oh, what's his name? Roger Bacon, I want to find out about him. Let's see if I read it. "The great astronomer John Herschel was another important contributor making extensive experiments in lights. I think he got the spectrograph on the light sensitivity of various metal salts and vegetable dyes, developing techniques for colour photographies and advancing terms now standard as such as negative positive snapshot photographer." Isn't that lovely? a negative and a positive, and it's Herschel photographer. Herschel photographer. Snapshot. I love the Herschel. Okay, the first such images still suggest the notion of the sun as the author, was the author, called the heliographs. In 1850, William Barnes, a Dorset peasant, got a 10-year Cambridge degree, tried to purge the English of letters and advocated replacing the word photograph with sun print. He found, I love it, a 10-year Cambridge degree. He failed, although for many years the Chambers English Dictionary included the definition of sun picture, a picture or print made by the agency of the sun rays, a photograph. Heliograph held its meaning until the early 1900s thereafter signified a military signal device. Yeah, that's what you get a little... Yeah, soldiers used to have little mirrors so we could reflect it into people's eyes. It's still back. It's still back in the Army Reserve in the 80s. A rivalry sprang up between photography and painting. Talbot, for instance, was fascinated by the camera's ability to catch the qualities of light reflected on glass, phenomena he believed challenging the best painters. Another early photographer, Roger Fenton, pointed his lens straight at the sun, seemingly in contravention of all known photographic principles to produce an early tangent effect. This desire to challenge painting and new technology confronting the techniques of earlier art continued throughout the early days of photography. Also, practitioners struggled to establish their medium's identity. Fenton's Salisbury Cathedral, the nave from the south transept, 1858, illustrates how the play of light and dark and interior space could be captured by the photographer by leaving the shutter open so long the edges of the shadows blurred under the sun's motion. He made the cathedral and more ethereal and registered the nuance of semi-darkness peculiar to the Gothic space. No wonder Ronald Barthes suggests that cameras were originally clocks for seeing. As now, I suppose, it's now clocks and nanosecond, femtosecond clocks. We can capture things before they happen. I just, so clocks and time are very, so photographs and time, it's a new, if the sun had a certain time or phases in the astronomical time, we've got photography, photographic time coming up. Exposure time was beginning to be as much an opportunity as a nuisance. When, in 1867, the great portress Julia Margaret Cameron took her celebrated photograph of John Herschel. Such was the poor quality of the indoor light that he had to sit hold for nearly 90 minutes, yet gave a greater depth to his cranky features. However, the next chapter of the story of photography in the sun was to be set in not in England but in Paris. Over the years, several cities have styled themselves as the City of Light, from Varese in north-central India to Lyon in southern France. But in the 1890s, Paris had asserted the prime claim. The term lumière, which embraces light, is much stronger than the English equivalent, additionally implying happiness, enthusiasm, and the world of art. Yet there is an irony in the title, for Paris was, for the most of its history, being a city of darkness. In the 13th century, it boasted a total of 3 public lamps. In the 15th and 16th century, a law required each household to place a candle in a street-facing window, but it was never enforced. Paris, the city of light, was in reality one of shadow. Isn't that interesting? James Joyce, 1842 to 1941, spent his final days in Paris, steadily losing sight, insisting by this, sitting by his window, wearing a dentist's jacket to reflect the sun on the open page. He would lay his head on his desk for better see what he is writing. His last manuscript slants heavily to the right, poignant evidence of his attempts to catch every particle of light that he could. So he lied at 99. Isn't that amazing, James Joyce? What a fantastic writer. I really have to, he did write Ulysses, so I should get that. However, in the run-up into the 1889 World Exhibition, whose literal highlight was the Eiffel Tower highlight, Paris was transformed by 20,000 gas lamps, making the nighttime photography possible. While on the outskirts of Lille, in northern France, a new factory was mass-producing photographs. It was a newly illuminated capital that the great Eugène Ajet, 1758 to 27, now became one of the first to exploit photography's potential as an art form, doing much to capture the great buildings and gardens of France. Early on in his career, he would photograph at midday, so this would say that his documents, as he would call them, would catch the finer details. In later studies, by contrast, he works in the early morning, when the soft luminosity suffuses its subjects with a sense of peace. In Roman literature, lux meant not only light, but life. Light is a term not of physics, but of physiology. Achet's work gave these words new meaning. And that is interesting. The ancients believed that light emanated from your eyes. So, yeah, the lights went out. Of living photographers who have been employed the sun to the greatest effect, one might cite the Swiss-American Robert Frank, born in 1924, whose classic book, The Americans, captured the cross-section, he'd be getting on, captures the cross-section of his countrymen in the middle 1950s. In his introduction, the beat writer Jack Kirvec acclaims Frank's capacity to convey not only the strange secrecy of Sedo, but that crazy feeling that America, when the sun is hot on the streets, the music comes out of the jukebox, or from a nearby funeral. Commenting on the particular shop, restaurant US 1, leaving Columbia, South Carolina, 1955, Couric describes how it shows the sun coming in the window and setting the chair in a holy glow I never thought could be caught on film. Frank is the nearest that American photography has come to Archet, so this is a central photographer. Heliography, heliograms, sun pictures, photograms, all such terms, and it's interesting that Herschel came up with snapshot, negative, positive, and photographer. All such terms underscored the degree to which the sun was co-creator of an art form in the early days, which is really interesting as you had different things, you had sun was your main illuminator. That's interesting. Amplifying its role in 1932, Edward Land, of Land Camera, it's fair, 1909 to 91, perfected the first usable material to polarize light officially, which in time yielded not only inexpensive filters for that purpose. In 1953, Land's company was producing 6 million pairs of cardboard frame 3D movie glasses each week. But the Polaroid camera, yet that was the last of his significant innovations in the technology of photography that concerned the sun. Because with the coming of digital photography in the 1970s, a drastic change occurred in the nature of the medium. But I still used photographic film, like I was a one-up. I was able to photograph films and put it in front of lasers to capture diffraction patterns. Like, there's nothing else. It was just fantastic. I really enjoyed doing that. I think the old dark ones today, you wouldn't be able, it would be too expensive. Okay. Cameras record the imagery of binary data, which facilitates the storage and editing of images on personal computers and deleting the unsuccessful takes. According to one historian, an, quote, existential doubt has crept in our understanding of these images, as the digital world would no longer permit a distinction between the real impression and a representation generated by the darkness of the computer. David Hockney has even described Gustave Le Gray's combining of two negatives in the 1850s to make a single print as a will deception that amounted to a form of silenced photography. Another commentator has pointed out a largely unquestioned assumption that the intrinsic essential nature of photographic apparatus to record factual reality has been completely overturned in traditional photography, which I think I'm a bit upset he hasn't covered mire scattering, it's sort of a major thing, and the fact that the digital representation of the sun is so now intense we can get mire scattering and scattering off hair, and I think, you know, you've got from Toy Story, the evolution of Toy Story, the things which with fur on them, I can't remember. Yeah, fur and feathers, very complicated thing to do in terms of photography. Another commentator who pointed out that, quote, a largely unquestioned assumption that the intrinsic and essential nature of photography apparatus is what we call factual reality has been completely overturned. Good. In traditional photography, it is possible to trace physical path from the objects represented to the light of reflect itself, to the photographic emulsion that the light hits, to the resulting image. In digital imaging, its path is not traceable. For additional step is added, converting the image to data, and thereby breaking the link between the image, that's a bit stupid, physical different. Any iteration of the image may be altered. There's no generational difference to alert us to the stage at which this change has occurred. Yeah, I suppose because you can do lens effects, digital lens effects. Such innovators as Lajic and Fenton might have replied that photography has ever been something of a trick, but others might feel that while the sun and photography have yet a formally divorced, they are surely going through a trial separation. Yeah, I suppose it's police photography, forensic photography, and all that type of stuff. With this 3D photography and LiDAR, photography has had a great many moments in the century since Daguerre, but the dominant medium of our time has proved to be the moving picture, and a truly art form to emerge during the 20th century. While photography was coming into its own, the technologies which make it possible, the art of the moving images were also being developed. In 1824, the English polymath Peter Mark Rochester Thoris, I would say, had published a paper arguing the human eye retains an image for a fraction of a second longer than the image is actually presented. This inspired inventors to demonstrate such a principle in practice, and it was found that in 16 pictures were made of movements that occurred over a span of 1 second, were shown to be compatible with time, the eye would register the image's continuous movement. That's why we have 30 frames, or even 100 frames per second. Gee, that's amazing. Which is rather interesting because you can still shake your head, and there's ways that you can peek around that 16 seconds. So if you shake your head, in the early monitors, if you chewed gum, looking at an early monitor, so this is a little thing, if you chewed gum, not that I chewed gum during my PhD, looking at the early monitors, the monitors would ripple. I don't think they do it nowadays. Okay. In 1832, a Belgian Joseph Plateau invented the phantoscope, a device to simulate motion. A series of pictures depicting a sequence of movement, juggling, dancing, was arranged around the edges of a solid disc. When this was put before the mirror and rotated, a spectator looking through the slots perceived a narrative sequence. Exactly 40 years later, the British photographer Edward Mulbridge, and I'll spell Edward for you, E-A-D-W-E-A-R-D, Edward. That's how artists get Edward. 1830 to 1904, employed 12 cameras to take 24 consecutive pictures of a trotting horse. Occident, I do remember this, Mulbridge. The Swede, with it any time, it had its feet off the ground simultaneously. By capturing Occident's four hooves in mid-air, thus verifying the unsupported transit theory, and experimenting also provide a major breakthrough for photography. Now, unsupported transit, it's amazing how these old theories, like that people really didn't understand what momentum was, even there. You know, momentum was discovered similarly, not many years earlier, people were looking at the moon, the balloons were rising due to Aristotle's vapours. Yeah. Okay, there's a footnote here. Mulbridge had become known for his landscape photographs of Chersonomite, had published them under the pseudonym Helios, perhaps an ironic way of acknowledging his co-creator. Well, I suppose that's interesting. And I'm sure this was, even though he was English, as I say, he was a British one, but he was in America. In 1876, building on yet early experiments, Mulbridge invented the zoopraxiscope, which projected a sequence series of photographs taken by multiple cameras in order to capture very small increments of motions that could be linked together to create moving pictures. In 1882, the Parisian psychologist Jean-Étienne Jules Marais constructed a photographic gun to take multiple images per second. The term shooting a film possibly derives from this. Around 1888, he was producing the first successful moving picture cameras capable of recording a flow of very brief shots of a subject's movements on the same plate, rather than individual images that Marais had produced. That same year, Thomas Edison, okay, so this is the image would move around a fixed plate or something. Edison, I remember that, completed the first ever film just ahead of the French brothers Louis-Auguste Lumière in 1895, combined printer, camera and projector to cast the moving pictures on the screen to an audience. In its earliest years, filmmaking depended almost entirely on the sun, on natural light falling through open roof studios. Edison formed the first movie unit in the US in 1893 by building the Buck Miriam, a tarpaud-covered shack in his New Jersey laboratories. Its stages were mounted on a platform that revolved to follow the sun's progress across the sky. In bad weather, he resorted to a greenhouse-like glass shelters, which retained whatever light was to be had. By 1897, Biograph, the first U.S. company devoted entirely to the new medium, its star director, D.W. Griffith, made 400 films for it, opened a studio with roofs of the Manhattan office block. Moving a few years later to the coveted Brown's Dome in 11 East 4th Street. Biograph's first indoor studio and the first in the world to rely exclusively on artificial light. Early in 1910, Biograph sent Griffith with a troupe of, including Lillian Gish, Mary Pickford, and Lionel Barrymore, to film Ramah in Los Angeles, then a town of fewer than 100,000 people. Okay, so that's to get light. So he was, you can imagine the Me Too movement there. The movie prompted in part by the search for better light, but more for the need to escape the patient disputes that often disrupted the production work back in the East. Okay, there's a footnote. At the time, Edison owned almost all the patents relevant to the motion picture production and often used to sue filmmakers acting independently in this motion picture parent company in the East. In California, filmmakers would work beyond the reach of his harassment. When he did send agents there, word usually arrived ahead of them, and competition could be escaped to Mexico. Well, that's interesting. So, if California was sufficiently close to Mexico, you could escape the border. Isn't that interesting? So, it was far away and had that thing, the sun and those contributors. Now, it's really interesting because my great-uncle was Australia's Arthur Shirley, one of Australia's greatest filmmakers. And the place was just full of litigation. So you might think litigation is today. Back then, it was just absolutely film. Filming completed Griffith's class gravitated north to a small community famous, if at all, for its flowers, Hollywood. We're much charmed by it. So left Los Angeles. Los Angeles is a toilet, as far as I can see. By 1911, another 15 film companies had arrived, so a year later in Hollywood, travelling westward to the land of haunted romance where the sun shines so fraudulently bright, as the film historian David Thompson puts it. An area proved so invigorating that by the end of the First World War, it had become the industry's capital. So that's 1918. So now that's interesting that, like, the Americans, you know, it'd be difficult. It'd be only be a few minor points to set. The sun dictated much of the early grammar of the film because in those pioneers' days, it was the only adequate source of light. Later, special sun arcs were developed to simulate the sunshine on demand. One such featured in Popular Science in January 23. A book, I don't think the film, measured a foot in diameter, making it the largest bulb in the world. These 30 kilowatt monsters consumed a third as much power as required to run a trolley car. What? A trolley car takes a megawatt of power? And such contained... It's 100 kilowatts. Each contained enough tungsten filament to operate 55,000 household lamps. That's not surprising because square laws. The first goal was simply to have enough light to film. However, as filmmakers became more concerned with the aesthetics of what they were shooting, it wasn't just the quantity but the quality of the light that mattered. Cinematographers fondly referred to the magic hour, the brief period when the twilight and the full darkness when the light was a deep, warm tone, sometimes known as sweet light because of its wondrous effect. And we have the sand twos in the army. It's so beautiful. You have this digging or marching, and then at that twilight where it goes between, you just all rest, all go in fire positions, and just wait for the light to change, and it changes the day noises of yourself. Like if you just walk, march into night, you have the, you can't acclimatise. It's a really good thing, that one. Okay. As cultural historian Michael Sims puts it, quote, "The most overlooked ordinary scenes are rusty basketball, blackboard, a sand-buried hurricane fence, a bedraggled starling on the dirty street, suddenly gain a new significance merely because they seem to abruptly to be touched the grandeurs of the sun's first or last light. As it happened in the painting, the sun itself started to play a role in the movies. Letting the camera linger on a rising or setting sun became a beloved motif for generations of directors. As Sims observes, the symbolic of a new beginning, a dawn, irresistible filmmakers as it was to writers. I'll tell you what, the sunset, sunrise from the Blue Mountains. So the sun rises on the back of Sydney and it is absolutely beautiful. Okay. It provides powerful visual metaphors, the blissful cinematographer in which the film Maru's sunrise and even sunlight in a new black and white day washing over Baghdad on the Hudson in Woody Allen's Manhattan. Baghdad on the Hudson. Allen is shown himself particularly sensitive to the light and bathes his hometown. New York, as the critic Holland Cotter has noted, is, quote, "an island city with an island light, alternately obscure and romantically moody. It can be too candid, but at, its toughness is democratic. It falls on everybody and everything." I don't know, New York again was... We were there in Yom Kippur, so it was completely dead. It was sort of like New York, the bomb had fallen. There was no one in the streets. It was just, just amazing. Not only from the term, Yom Kippur is a Jewish holiday. So sort of just bizarre. Get a grip. Okay. Not only dawn and sunset, draw the camera's lens. Many notable films have drawn directly on the sun. Cinematographer Kuze Muraga, 1908 to 1909, was the first to turn the camera directly into its glare, albeit through the foliage. I think isn't he the one that does the stop motion? And Akira Kurosawa, Rashomon, 1950, and Conrad Hall was the first to do so in colour. In Cool Hand Luke, 1967. So that would be interesting. Other films that feature the sun for the purposes of moon and meeting include Yves von Stolheim's Greed, 1924, with the final scenes of California's Death Valley superbly conveying the full force of the desert heat and the wretchedness of despair, the desert from thirst. Although people, Death Valley's actually decided to all go across it and they all die. Nicholas Roeg's visually dazzling Walkabout, that's an Australian film, 1971, shot in the Australian outback. Michael Angelo's Antony the Passenger, which lands Jack Nicholson in the African desert. Even Desert Hopper's 1968. Yes, hon? Okay. Have to stop here. returning to continue podcasting to this Chasing the Sun, halfway through the chapter of Negative Capabilities. It's talking about the film and the sun. And it did a little bit about how Hollywood went to the West Coast for the sun and also to escape patents. The patent long reach of Edison. Now, let's read this. All the arts... we've just gone through the various parts. My most cherished example of cinematic depiction of the sun is the opening scene from Festival of Beauty, Part 2 of Leni Riefenstahl's Olympian, her chronicle of the 1936 Games in Berlin. The shots of athletes preparing for a day against the backdrop of a moody, then resplendent sun movingly evoke the harmony of a sportsman and a sportswoman with nature. The film is in black and white, so it'd be a nice film to see. Okay, all the arts connected with nature, but all the arts connect with nature. But this is particularly true of architecture, or better, for better, sometimes worse. I've mentioned the ways in which certain buildings have been constructed to record the sun's movement, reflect the rays, catch them, and as an aid to good health. But the architecture can prove to be the enemy of the sun. As early as 1902, for instance, Manhattan boasted 181 edifices of 10 to 19 stories high, and 3 over 20. John Chernak describes the result in his History of the Empire State Building. It's quite famous. Now, there's the sun laws in Britain, which I have to remember. Streets that had once been bathed in midday sun are becoming dark and narrow canyons. The financial districts came to be described as the Canyon of Wall Street. The canyons appeared, canyons where sunlight seldom reaches the sidewalks below, canyons that rose straight up for 200, 300 feet or more, canyons created not by erosion but by economics. If the problem was at its worst in America, it was repeated elsewhere, and architects worldwide duly took notice. Le Corbusier, 1887 to 1965, one of the most influential architects of the last century, wrote, quote, "The materials of the urban design are sun, sky, trees, steel, cement, in this order of importance, space and light and order. Those are the things that men need just as much as they need bread and or a place to sleep." In 1922, he proposed a contemporary town of 3 million inhabitants, the centerpiece of which was to be a group of 60-story skyscrapers. In the years that followed, he reformulated his ideas of interior design, particularly in Ville Soye, his Temple of the Sun, in Poissy, on the outskirts of Poissy, the outskirts of Paris. Completed in 1929, and of urbanism, finally giving them a concrete shape in the Unité d'Habitation at Marseille, built between 1946 and 1952, an 18-floor apartment block that shared many of the features with the heliopathic clinic. Dueling our cosmic energy, the sun's effects are both physical and moral. They have been too much neglected in recent time, he declared, revealing his concern about tuberculosis. The results of that clinic can be seen in the cemetery of the sanatorium. The Marseille, I'll have to read this, the Marseille building was open to sunlight at all times of the day, with its balconies serving as sunscreens, and were designed to allow sunshine into the flats in winter and shade in summer. Okay. The 150-foot Statue of Liberty bearing the crown of Mithras. Oh, that's interesting. Since the 1940s, it has been acclaimed that the Seven Spikes of Liberty's dame epitomised not Mithras, but the seven seas and the seven continents. But equally, that's some interesting work here, but equally it could represent the crown worn by the Roman emperors as part of the cult of Sol Invictus, or the headpiece of the solar deity Apollo. Nobody knows for sure. So why not accept the crown as inspired by the sun? Oh, that's interesting. Seven things, I really get that. when you're an Aussie looking at it. Now, there's a footnote for summer. The designs of building in hot weather have often included sun baffles or sunbreakers, known as brise-soleils, placed on the outside of windows and over the entire surface of buildings. Different countries have tried different means to reduce the glare. Lattices, schlich or maschwitz, pierce the screen's quermia, as used in the Taj Mahal, or blinds of split-mute bamboos, used in Japan, Sundari. One of Le Corbusier's most lasting innovations was substantial brise-soleil in 1933, taken up around the world, whatever that one is. Okay, there's another footnote coming up. We took those precepts of stage further in the Indian city of Changari, a combination covering 114 square kilometres at the base of the Himalayas. While much of which he designed, working on his plans from 1951 until he died in 56, Changari was a new city that had been built from scratch to house the many refugees fleeing Pakistan after the catastrophic partition of British India in 1947. Its designs were meant to embody the ideals of independent nation, but it was also important that Le Corbusier to take account of the demanding Punjab climate, where May and June may have temperatures reaching 115 degrees Fahrenheit, whatever that means in Celsius. Three elements of his design, particularly sculptural, partially architectural, underscore his preoccupation with the sun. 24 solar hours is inscribed on the 45-metre-wide inclined face of the city's geometric hill, with the Tower of Shadows occupies a square of 15.5 metres. Its facade is designed to give maximum shade, and the course of the sun consists of two parabolic steel arches standing in a pool of water. Other parts of the city are equal sun conscious. The High Court buildings are designed specifically for tropically rainy climate. It even has Le Corbusier's signature parasol roof and an overhanging roll-up lid of concrete to fend off the rain and sun. Oh, I really wish I could see it. So I should be tired, but I've done a bit of walking and it's a bit of work for me. Okay. The longing to live in houses facing the sun has continued over the ages, sometimes with unexpected results. In the 18th century, when the city of Bath was completely reconstructed, one of its leading architects, John Wood the Younger, created the Royal Crescent, several of whose 30 otherwise uniform Palladian houses could not face south. For years, with such social importance on receiving the morning sun, that no one would live in them. On the other hand, some had rather too much sunlight. The white glare at Jane Austen's noted in Nottingham Anger Abbey. Oh, well, they're all a bit fussy, those poms, aren't they? Of all the modern architects, Le Corbusier was the most aware of the sun's effect on people in their daily lives. Current practitioners may wish they were more so. In the case of Franz Greer's $274 million Walt Disney concert hall, it looks like a complete piece of garbage to me, where the glare from the stainless steel facade has imperiled drivers and raised the temperature of nearby cars at pavement to 138 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's a bit over 40, 50. Hot enough to melt plastic traffic cones and set off spontaneous blaze and rubbish bins. 10 minutes exposure to the state-of-art building under the bright sun, such as LA's famous Lebos, can inflict bad sunburn. In 2005, just 2 years after the concert hall opened, its surfaces had to be sandblasted to a dim brightness, and so it was all so unnecessary for Sydney Opera House. Built between 59 and 73, its roof is made of precisely 1,156,056 glazed white tiles, specially treated miniaturized glass, specially treated to minimize glare. Similar buildings, especially those with concave surfaces, now have tested at the planning stages to ensure for overheating. So they don't form a lens. Architects have learned to grade the sun's effects according to three levels of increasing intensity. Veiling reflectors, discomfort glare, and disability glare. As of this writing, Gehry is constructing an extension of the Philadelphia Museum of Art entirely underground. I visited that. So that's the end of that one. And we're on to the next chapter called Talks of the Day. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.